Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome back to Ruination, the early years. We are strapping in for another deep dive, and this week we're analyzing the foundational and, to be honest, the truly chaotic origins of Big Fatty Online.
We are. We're looking at a very specific stretch here.
We are. It's April 7th through the 11th, 2008, so that's BFO. Episodes 47 right through to 51.
And this block of content is just so crucial. It has some of the most, intimate listener calls ever, a delivery of Girl Scout cookies that became iconic, and a really huge structural moment.
The 50th episode.
A big 5-0. But what makes this week so fascinating from a structural standpoint is that it was all born from a piece of critical feedback.
Right. The show's identity up to this point had really been defined by a lot of interaction with his network of other podcasters.
Heavily. And this week, we see this deliberate, almost strategic attempt by the host to create what he called No Podcaster Voice Letters Week.
It was a full-on campaign. He was trying to shift the spotlight away from his peers, who were, his most frequent callers, and intentionally put it on the quieter, quote, non-podcaster listeners.
The ones who made up the broader audience, but maybe hadn't called in before.
Okay, so let's really unpack that. This wasn't just like a friendly suggestion. It was basically a mission statement for the week.
He was trying to prove something.
Yeah, he was trying to prove, probably to himself as much as anyone, that BFO wasn't just this, incestuous little network of podcasters all talking to each other.
And by deliberately going after these new, unvarnished, totally amateur voices, the show just exploded with this incredibly diverse, deeply personal, and often hilarious content.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about everything from, super detailed dining reviews to accidental celebrity gossip and some very personal confessions about what people like to eat.
And that pivot, that successful shift, culminates so perfectly in episode 50. That milestone gave him the perfect excuse to do a retrospective, to do some self-reflection, and really celebrate this shared cultural history he was building.
So the big insight from this week is that the authentic, unfiltered amateur feedback, which was, the original promise of the voice letter system, wasn't it?
It was. And it became the most powerful content engine the show had. It cemented the entire BFO brand for years to come.
So we have to start with the catalyst then. What was the thing that actually triggered this sudden dedicated week of excluding his very vocal podcaster friends?
Well, it wasn't some big strategic meeting. It was just one specific piece of listener feedback. It all comes down to Freddie's call.
Freddie's call. Okay.
Freddie calls in, and the beauty of it is just how observant his comment was. He basically says he appreciates that the host even pointed out that most callers were other podcasters.
So he's validating the host's self-awareness.
Exactly. Freddie was speaking for that quieter group, confirming that, yes, non-podcaster listeners like him exist, and they really appreciate the show's unscripted banter. That was the word he used.
I love that word, banter. It's such high praise for a show that, often just sounds like two friends rambling on the phone.
It is. Yeah. But this call was more than just praise. It was validation. It was proof.
Proof that the silent majority was out there. They were listening closely, and they wanted a chance to be heard without having to, fight for airtime with all the network regulars.
And that confirmation is what directly inspired the host to dedicate the whole week to new voices. He threw down the challenge, get on the bag phone.
Which is probably a good point to clarify for anyone new who's diving into these early years with us.
Oh, yeah.
When you hear them talk about the bag phone, they're talking about the voice letter number, which was and still is 206-337-1438.
Right. It's a term that just perfectly highlights the host's love for older, slightly out-of-date technology.
Yeah.
It adds this layer of nostalgia to the whole thing.
Totally. And the second that call to action went out, the beautiful chaos just began. The very first voice letter that he played under this new policy was from a friend he just called the Baby Jar.
The Baby Jar. He'd been visiting for the Cooper River Bridge Run, which is a great little detail that grounds the show in the host's actual real life.
But the timing is what makes this so fantastic, right?
It's everything. The Baby Jar left the call after the host had already gone to bed. He had no idea the show was still recording or that his, casual messages might end up being primetime content.
A completely spontaneous audio postcard. And the content of that voicemail is just pure accidental BFO gold. The baby jar is talking about arriving at his hotel, which he calls the Pink Chico Hotel.
Which is already a great name.
And he says he's hungry, and then he demands to be fed by the big fat cock.
And you have to pause there. That accidental, incredibly explicit slip of the tongue, which he then immediately corrects to big fatty.
Right, a slightly less intense but still pretty provocative correction.
That moment of self-correction captured live is exactly why these unpolished voice letters are so compelling. It's the real, spontaneous dialogue from the host's life just bleeding into the show.
That kind of accidental intimacy really set the tone for the entire week. It was all raw, unedited, and super personal.
But the baby jar wasn't just about chaotic voicemails. He also brought new content to the show, specifically the Queer Duck movie.
Right, Queer Duck, the animated cartoon that started out as like a short for a Showtime series called Webisodes.
And the host was clearly so excited about this contribution. He immediately starts listing the main characters for the listeners. You've got Queer Duck, the super cynical bipolar bear, Openly Gator, and Oscar Wildcat.
It just shows how fast the show could absorb these spontaneous media recommendations into its, you know, its very fabric.
He even posted a clip online making sure that the baby jar's visit translated into actual shareable content for the whole community.
Yeah.
It's proof that the BFO content pipeline was fueled by his personal circle, but the delivery was totally public.
The calls that came in after that really showed how well the audience understood the host's very specific, and let's be honest, sometimes bizarre, needs for appreciation.
This is where we get the "you're fat" fan mail.
Yeah.
It was quickly becoming this required sign-off, almost like a password to get into the community.
It's incredible. So first up was Brian in Denver. He praises the show, says he's catching up on iTunes, and then he ends his call with the required punchline, "and you're fat."
He's totally fluent in the BFO lexicon. He knew exactly what the host wanted to hear because the host had, in a way, trained him.
Then James in LA follows his lead. And I love his little geographic clarification. He's calling from Los Angeles, not Lower Alabama.
A great line. And James compliments the Memory Lane music segment, which is a huge compliment given how deep the host goes on obscure TV themes.
He specifically mentions having a huge crush on Sandy from Flipper. That's Luke Halpin. And even adds a little trivia, noting that Flipper was a movie before it was a TV show.
And then crucially, James closes with the now mandatory sign-off. And by the way, you're fat.
This is where you can really analyze it. This isn't just a compliment. It's a required password. It proves the listener is fluent in the brand's very specific, counterintuitive cultural language.
The willingness to deliver what is on its face an insult is the highest form of respect in this world.
It truly is. The host had successfully weaponized the insult. Hearing the word "fat" was the ultimate badge of honor, of belonging.
And James also opened the door for more Flippers content, which led the host to play a clip later that was sent in by Michael from Stout God in Germany.
Joking that Flipper was, and I quote, "the big old gay German fish." The content just keeps building on itself, drawing more and more people in through these shared inside jokes.
But the call that really defined the blend of domestic life, absurdity, and community engagement for the week had to be Jeremiah's call.
Oh, yeah. The one that launched the now legendary Samoa cookie saga.
Jeremiah starts with a classic bit of BFO humor, saying he's going to send a fax one day because the host wants one so bad. He's playing right into the host running gag about his love for old tech.
But his main topic was his extensive due diligence to find Samoa cookies after all the local Girl Scout troops were sold out.
Using the term due diligence for tracking down a snack is just, it elevates the whole thing into this heroic quest.
And the specific details are just priceless. He says he finally located them at a Democrat Girl Scout troop in town.
A fantastic, localized political observation that just tells you so much.
He confirmed the cookies were in the mail, quest fulfilled, but Jeremiah wasn't done. He then used his airtime to defend the host on other, totally separate sagas that were going on.
He did. He specifically defended Ole Miss's rich history of sports and mentioned a gathering in the Grow at homecoming, just inserting himself into this ongoing sports debate.
And he also defended the complete absurdity of the Mississippi grandmother story, saying it was, and I quote, "not out of the realm of possibility at all whatsoever." He even joked the courtroom drama should be on TV.
He is co-creating the host's reality.
He really is. But the key structural detail, the one that makes the host's life sound like a scripted soap opera, is the explicit warning. He says not to let the ex-husband Larry Hava have any of the cookies, noting, and this is the absolute kicker, that the cookies were included in the divorce settlement.
I mean, you just have to stop right there. The cookies are no longer food. They're a plot device. They are a crucial element of a fictional divorce settlement that was either invented or at least massively amplified by the audience.
It's the highest form of personalized fan service. Jeremiah just seamlessly merged BFO lore with real-world generosity.
And the host confirmed the real-world impact of that call almost immediately.
Yeah.
He shared that he'd received a clicking ship notification from the USPS.
Another piece of BFO jargon. Clicking ship is the specific phrase he uses for when he gets a tracking confirmation. It ties a very technical detail to the, you know, the emotional excitement of getting a package.
And he made a promise to the listeners. He said he would crack that box open on the air one day this week.
The No Podcaster Week continued its streak of accidental intimacy with Miss Kathy and what I like to call the bacon confessional.
Kathy calls in, identifies as a non-podcaster listener. She's heading to San Diego for work. Try and keep listening on the download.
And she accidentally says the word Josh instead of gosh, which the host, ever the editor of his own life, immediately corrects on the air.
But the follow-up to this is what's so illuminating. It shows the intimacy, but also the anxiety that these new callers felt. Kathy immediately sent an e-letter asking him not to play the message because she thought she sounded, quote, stupid.
She had the courage to call, but then that immediate regret that you feel after you put yourself out there.
And the host, who is just a master of boundary negotiation and reassurance, he convinced her to let him play it.
And how did he do it? By joking that he would play crickets after her message and that the message would make people think about bacon, which she loves. He turned her self-conscious mistake into a celebration of her favorite food.
And she totally leaned into it. She even uploaded a picture of herself to the listener map, and she admitted it took, quote, 67 tries to get the right one.
That single detail, 67 tries, it just illustrates the high stakes that were involved in joining this community. It's not just a show you listen to. It's a place where you're expected to represent yourself visually and audibly, and that whole process is terrifying for new people.
Absolutely. The final piece of the non-podcaster content was the late arrival, Tom from Virginia.
Right. Tom calls in during the dedicated week, says he loved the show, and is glad the host is into the whole horror scene.
A nice little niche connection.
And the host, ever the community builder, notes that Tom isn't on the listener map and immediately uses it as an opportunity. He asks if Tom is also involved in the horror scene. It's a phishing attempt, you know, to generate more content and solidify their shared interests.
And he closes out the call by mentioning his own upcoming travel to the Hara Hotel. Even the smallest piece of feedback is leveraged to generate more connection and push for that map membership. The mechanism is just constant.
So as the show is growing through all these authentic voice letters, so is the physical digital representation of its community. Listener Map saw a huge expansion this week, and its name, the Ruined Listener Map, just perfectly captures the BFO brand.
That name is fantastic. Because it's born out of a technical failure that he turned into a cynical joke. The host called it ruined because it was so fat it will not fit inside the box and it takes fucking ever to load.
So the technical flaws, the sluggishness, the bloat, that becomes the brand identity. The map is ruined because it's too popular. It's too fat.
It's brilliant self-deprecation. It sets the expectation for you, the listener. Nothing here is going to work perfectly, and that's kind of the point.
So let's look at some of the new members who stuck their pins in the map during this period. We had Maddie Malone from Malone, New York.
And the host immediately gets fixated on the name, wondering if the town was named after Maddie's family.
Maddie's quote was perfectly aligned with the show's dark humor. It was, "Let the ruination run rampant." A clear sign they understood the title and the whole theme of the show.
Then you had Paul, the kitten whisperer from Philadelphia, longtime listener who finally got pinned. His quote was really warm and inviting.
Give me a yo when you come my way.
It's these personal, informal invitations that turn a digital map from just a static list into like a potential travel itinerary for future meetups. It bridges the virtual and the real worlds.
Then Mia from Chicago provided one of the best examples of a backhanded compliment of the entire week.
Oh, this one's great.
You are my favorite fat gay podcaster, except for Archer because he's way fatter.
And the host, always pragmatic and committed to the running joke about his size, he just immediately agreed with her. He appreciated the compliment and the context.
And Scott from Columbus, Ohio, delivered a classic self-aware joke that really summed up the listener's commitment. I was ruined by Big Fatty, and all I got was this lousy pen icon.
He understood the absurdity of the payoff. You submit all this personal info and voice letters, and your reward is a tiny digital icon.
But the newest, and maybe the most commented on, addition was Afro Jamaicano from Kentucky.
Yes. The host described him in very sexualized, complimentary terms. Mm. Delicious, with big, muscly arms.
And this brings us to a really crucial point of analysis here. His quote was simple. Hey, big fatty, love the show, you're fat. Standard BFO sign-off.
Pretty standard, yeah.
But the host, never one to miss an opportunity to push the explicit boundary of the show, he openly wondered, live on the air, what it would take to see a picture of his pants off.
That willingness to turn community engagement into open sexual commentary is, I mean, that's core BFO. But I have to ask, was there any recorded instance of this approach crossing a line for the audience? Did he ever get pushback for actively soliciting a listener's pant-off picture, even as a joke?
That's a great question. In the early years, the recorded pushback was minimal. It suggests that the audience very quickly learned that this was part of the deal. If you entered the BFO universe, you understand that your identity, your body, your contributions, they are all subject to the host's uncensored commentary.
So it's an expectation management strategy.
Exactly. The audience is signing up for the edge. That risk is the content.
A fascinating dynamic. The audience accepts the high-stakes risk for the reward of community and recognition. But speaking of the audience's accidental perception, we need to talk about the search term confessional.
Yes, a true unvarnished window into BFO's identity as seen through the, you know, the prism of Google algorithms.
The host got a search report detailing exactly how people were finding the show, and it is a phenomenal document.
The top six terms were predictable. They mirrored the show's title, Fatty Big Online, Big Fatty Online, BigFattyOnline.com, and podcast. That's the official brand.
But then you get into the bizarre, the non sequitur terms that reveal the pure chaos that the search engines associated with BFO. This is where the accidental public identity comes from. Look at this list. Buy big movies, Vera Auntie Charles music, home cam, and Fatty's mom. How does typing mom lead you to Big Fatty Online?
It's algorithmic drift at its finest. I mean, we have to guess here. Fatty's mom is probably just natural curiosity, right? An attempt to ground the host's persona in a family.
Sure. And home cam might connect to his frequent descriptions of his daily life, suggesting people expected, I don't know, live amateur footage of his house.
But Vera Auntie Charles music, what is that?
That is genuinely puzzling. It sounds like a misremembered name, maybe a piece of obscure soul music, or a reference to a forgotten TV show from one of the Memory Lane segments. It shows the listener is often searching for other content that the host just mentioned in passing.
And the search engine just decides BFO is the authority on it.
Right. And then you get to the genuinely confusing phrases like map update, which is kind of logical. And then the almost nonsensical one, contract what because is right price.
The host expresses this genuine, hilarious confusion over this one, just asking, who searches for that?
It sounds like, I don't know, a non-native English speaker trying a business transaction search. And somehow, the algorithm thinks BFO, the home of gay German fish jokes and divorce settlement cookies, is the most relevant result. It just highlights the vast, bizarre reach of the show's signal.
And, of course, the infamous terms that confirm the show's explicit identity. Unusual penises. The host, with his usual cynicism, just sort of accepted that typing, quote, penises would inevitably lead you to Big Fatty Online.
And then the final self-critical summary, typed by some unhappy person, mean and weird.
This confessional is so critical because it forces the host to see his brand synthesized, not by his own careful curation, but by the outside world's accidental searches, its unfiltered desires, and its negative reactions.
So the host thinks he's running a podcast, mm-hmm. but the outside world sees his brand as this bizarre, algorithmically generated word cloud of penises, Fatty's mom, and mean and weird.
And he's not fighting it. He's embracing that chaos. That, more than anything, tells you where the show is headed.
Okay, let's ground ourselves in the domestic reality of the host during this really intense week, starting with his meticulously detailed food stories.
Yes, we have the retap of the Sunday night dinner, which is always worth analyzing for its strategic significance.
Absolutely. The host had dinner with Larry Cly and the Baby Jar at the Mellow Mushroom, which is a pizza place known for its laid-back vibe.
And the detail starts with the appetizers. Homemade pretzels, which he noted were made from pizza dough, and were delicious. That attention to the ingredients source pizza dough, it shows his deep appreciation for culinary specifics.
Then his main course was the buffalo chicken pizza, complete with blue cheese, bacon, and onions. But crucially, he could only finish half. He saved the other half for his lunch on Monday.
And that small detail of domestic economy and planning provides this fascinating contrast to the chaotic, unscripted content of the show. The online persona is raunchy and unpredictable, but the domestic routine is meticulous. It's planned.
He also briefly reminisced about a separate food memory that week, a trip to Sibor in Milwaukee. Sibor, he notes, is Spanish for meat on a sword, which immediately tells you it's a Brazilian steakhouse, a foco de cao style place.
A true high-end, all-you-can-eat meat experience, a real commitment to high-caloric indulgence.
But his main observation wasn't about the food quality or the specific cuts of meat, which is what you might expect. No, it was about the clientele.
He noted that he saw the fattest people I've ever seen in my life at the restaurant or just in Milwaukee in general.
And that observation is vintage BFO travel commentary. It's that blend of high-end indulgence dining at a Brazilian steakhouse with this sharp, unfiltered, and maybe slightly judgmental, but also self-aware observation about body size.
He's acknowledging the setting while also applying his own fatty brand to the world around him.
But the centerpiece of this entire segment and the fulfillment of a huge content promise made to the listener was the Samoa Cookie Box opening.
Delivered by Jeremiah, the entire week had been building to this moment.
The host opened the USPS clicking ship package live on air, turning the whole unpacking process into this dramatic performance. He noted the box was stuffed with newspapers, which is a great physical detail that shows the practical care Jeremiah took in shipping it.
Then he began the reveal first, the eagerly awaited Samoas, which were immediately designated for the freezer, a strategic move to ensure their longevity.
And controlled rationing. But then things got weird.
Very weird. Then came the peanut butter cookies, the Dosidos, which inexplicably had rubber bands wrapped around them.
And he paused. Genuinely confused by the rubber bands. They offered no logical explanation for shipping protection or freshness. He just accepted the strange packaging. But the mystery of the rubber bands became yet another bizarre, unscripted detail for the listeners to analyze.
And finally, a box of sugar-free chocolate chip cookies, which, again, shows the complexity of the community. Jeremiah was clearly trying to cater to the host's health-conscious side while still providing treats.
The host appreciated them, noting they were, quote, made with real chocolate chips as opposed to the fake ones, adding this layer of quality assessment.
And the bonus items just cemented this package as a physical manifestation of the BFO universe. There is a copy of the Advocate magazine via a subscribe and save card, which confirms the host's political and community identity.
And then the ultimate non sequitur, a postcard for a timeshare-like property promising to, quote, own sand destined for life.
It's the perfect contradictory delivery. Comfort food, health consciousness, political identity, and a bizarre, unsolicited luxury sales pitch. Jeremiah packed so many conflicting elements into one simple box. It's a masterclass in personalized fan mail.
Moving on to network news, this week was absolutely packed with updates confirming the explosion and the structural evolution of the whole RNL podcasting network.
We had major news show launches announced. Ryan and Jason in Orlando were launching The Way We See It, and they were scheduled to record that very Wednesday.
And also, Michael, Eric the Southern Boy, Walt from We're Mean, and Wes from Live It Up were starting a comic book podcast. The host vaguely recalled it being called H is for Homosexual or something like that.
The fact that he can't quite remember the title shows his focus is really just on his own production. He joked that he would just stick to his own quiz programs, which is a reference to the occasional trivia segments he runs.
And we also had the return of Jaded City. Tristan was bringing his show back after having quit because he claimed he only had about 4,500 listeners, which is a really high number for the time.
The host noted this with a bit of cynical amusement, emphasizing the high, maybe unrealistic standards some podcasters had, especially compared to BFO's focus on intimacy over just sheer numbers.
And finally, we got a brief but potent update on a long-running saga, the confrontation with the despised airline agent.
Yes, for new listeners, this is the CMC saga, the host's long-running feud with the airline agent he frequently referred to by a very derogatory name.
And this week, the host mentioned getting a phone call from the agent's lawyer, the lawyer for C. McHunt C.
The fact that a dispute, which was probably rooted in a simple travel incident, had escalated to the point of lawyers getting involved shows how the host's personal vendettas become these central dramatic plot points in the show.
And his reaction was just immediate dismissal. He named the lawyer Crazy Matt Craze Craze and expressed total confidence that he would win any dispute.
He weaponizes the legal threat. He converts that external pressure into more content, dismissing the lawyer with a catchy, alliterative nickname. It confirms that even low-level legal threats are just more fuel for the BFO content engine. The drama is never allowed to exist off mic.
This next section is really the structural anchor of the entire week. April 10th, 2008 was episode 50, a monumental milestone that required a dedicated celebration and a look back.
And the host, in classic fashion, called it his golden show, deliberately joking about the golden shower reference, noting that the air was scratched off.
It's pure BFO, celebrating a mark of maturity with 50 episodes while simultaneously celebrating the crude immaturity that defines so much of the show's humor.
The gift to the listener for this milestone was a huge two-part special. It consumed episodes 50 and 51, and it featured a massive retrospective of all the past Memory Lane music themes.
Episode 50 covered themes from the first half, so episodes 1 through 26, ending with Father Knows Best.
And then episode 51 the next day covered the themes from episodes 27 through 49. This two-part compilation basically turned The Daily Show into this huge celebration of early BFO nostalgia.
The host was really excited about it. He actively challenged the audience to guess all the themes, which was basically a test of their fluency in BFO culture. He was certifying the early history of the show, making the audience feel like they were part of a canon.
The compilation spanned an incredible range of niche 60s and 70s TV, which gives you deep insight into the host's cultural foundation. You can kind of group the themes to understand his nostalgic palette.
You had the wholesome, early domestic comedy and drama, Petticoat Junction, Father Knows Best, Here's Lucy. Then the 70s lighthearted fun like The Love Boat, Love American Style, and Welcome Back, Cotter.
And crucially, the obscure, often ridiculous cartoon and failure content. Super Chicken, My Mother the Car, a celebrated failure of the 60s and Beanie and Cecil. The host isn't just nostalgic, he's specifically nostalgic for the cultural fringes, the high concept failures, and the absurd children's programming of his youth.
That combination confirms the BFO sensibility. It's equal parts sweetness from classic domesticity and deep cynical absurdity from things like My Mother the Car.
Other key themes mentioned in the compilation were Good Morning Captain, The Love Garden, Here Come the Brides, the Doris Day Show's theme, Que Sera Sera, Top Cat, Speed Racer, Flipper, Concentration, and the vocal version of That Girl.
But beyond the big compilation, we need to focus on the daily Memory Lane music he played in the non-compilation shows that week, because they brought their own unique trivia.
On Monday, episode 47, the theme was The Mothers-in-Law, which was suggested by John from Illy. It ran from 1967 to 1969 on NBC.
And the crucial context the host provided was that it was produced by Desi Arnaz after his divorce from Lucille Ball, but he used the same prolific writers, Bob Carroll and Madeline Pugh Davis from I Love Lucy.
This is more than just trivia. It's an intellectual connection. The host is pointing out that the DNA of I Love Lucy, that perfected domestic chaos, was running through the veins of this highly obscure, short-lived show.
The premise itself sounds like pure domestic absurdity. You've got two families, the Hubbards and the Buells, whose children marry and then move into one of the garages.
The host summed up his appreciation for the show's acting talent perfectly. He asks, who doesn't love a Kay Ballard where she bites her hand and an Eve Arden? It shows a very specific appreciation for classic comedic acting styles.
On Tuesday, episode 48, we got a rare double feature, Make Room for Daddy and That Girl.
Make Room for Daddy, starring Danny Thomas, was a hugely popular early TV show. The essential trivia link that the host emphasized was that Danny Thomas's daughter is Marlo Thomas.
And that connection flows immediately into That Girl, the much more modern show that ran from 66 to 71 on ABC. It starred Marlo Thomas as Anne Marie, an aspiring actress from Brewster, New York, living in New York City.
And her writer boyfriend was Ted Bessel, who played Donald Hollinger. The host emphasized a really critical piece of trivia here that most listeners probably overlook.
That many people don't remember the theme song actually had words, and he played the vocal version. This is the ultimate test of niche nostalgia, knowing the difference between the instrumental version and the vocal version of a forgotten theme.
He also mentioned the specific SNL parody, That Black Girl. And including that detail shows his keen awareness of how classic TV gets reinterpreted through contemporary comedy. He's blending his deep nostalgia with a sharp awareness of modern cultural commentary.
And finally, on Wednesday, episode 49, we got the soap opera powerhouse Falcon Crest.
Ran from 1981 to 1990 on CBS, a massive nighttime drama centered on the feuding Chanin-Gioberti family in the fictitious Tuscany Valley just north of San Francisco.
It's classic 80s drama, wealth, betrayal, and wine. The key stars were Jane Wyman and Lorenzo Lamas. The show was famously described as, quote, Dallas with grapes when it premiered.
It was a very obvious attempt to replicate the success of the rival primetime soap. And in a nod to network politics, the host explicitly connected the theme directly to fellow podcaster Archer.
By doing that, he pulls a piece of 80s cultural history into the current network landscape, making the trivia relevant to his audience's current listening habits.
The structural importance of this retrospective week just can't be overstated. By halting the forward momentum of The Daily Show for 2 days to reflect on 50 episodes of musical themes, the host was teaching his audience a crucial lesson.
That BFO was already an archive. It was a shared cultural history worthy of celebration, memorization, and analysis. This solidified the show's chaotic ethos into a recognizable shared structure.
Hitting 51 shows in less than 4 months is, I mean, a huge achievement, especially when you're juggling all that network gossip, food reporting, and audience chaos.
He took a moment for some genuine reflection, thanking listeners for supporting these first 51 episodes of the BFO journey.
He said he hoped they had fun and maybe got comfortable calling the bag phone or visiting the website. His focus was entirely on encouraging longevity and community participation.
He wasn't just asking for downloads. He was urging them to continue telling friends and dropping comments. The show was so fundamentally built on continuous, genuine interaction. And he just reinforced that mechanism right up to the sign-off. He knew that listener engagement was his most precious resource.
And as always, the host made sure the audience knew exactly what to expect next. He immediately set the theme for the following week. Cartoon Memory Lane Week.
More nostalgia, more trivia, and another highly cohesive thematic structure.
He ended with the final call to action, reminding listeners to visit the website, bigfatonline.com, and call the voice letter number, 206-337-1438, and to, quote, give me your good gosh and gamey.
And that sign-off, combining a polite Southern expression, good gosh, with his explicit identity, gamey, it just perfectly encapsulates the show's unique blend of the sweet and the provocative.
So if we look back at this entire week, the no podcaster experiment, the detailed tracking of cookies tied to a fictional divorce settlement, the Golden Show retrospective, what does it all fundamentally mean for the show's longevity and its identity?
It proves that the deliberate structural shift away from established podcasters and toward the general non-podcaster listener was the genius move. The show successfully proved that its content thrives not on expert commentary or polished interviews, but on authentic, unfiltered amateur feedback.
Cretty's call was the ignition.
It was. But the calls that followed, from the Baby Jar's explicit accidental demands to Jeremiah's fictional divorce cookies to Kathy's self-conscious confession, they gave the host raw, intimate, and often hilarious material that no script could ever match.
So the chaos of the audience is the stability of the show.
Precisely. The host provided the platform, the structure, and the personality, but the audience provided the entire plot. The lesson here is that the most enduring content often comes from lowering the bar of professionalism and just embracing the genuine, sometimes awkward enthusiasm of the amateur.
Running the show daily gave him the freedom to let the audience's chaos become the script.
It's a paradox, isn't it? The more unfiltered and amateur the audience became, the more solid and professional the BFO brand became.
That's a powerful idea. It makes you think, are the most authentic connections in your life built on highly polished professional exchanges? Or are they built on those raw, unedited, slightly embarrassing moments that you share only with your closest circle?
Like the contents of a divorce settlement or the fact that it took you 67 tries to get the right profile picture, the host found a way to take those awkward amateur moments and turn them into mandatory listening.
That transformation of vulnerability into virality is the core of Ruination, the early years. Thanks for diving deep with us.
We'll see you next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.